Russians are coming.
Oh, do you think so?
That's fake news, dude.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In today's show...
What is going to be seen as acceptable speech and acceptable political practice remains to be seen, because we are entering a new totalitarian era.
High-tech censorship.
In theory, agencies like the FBI, CIA, NSA should have no access to health data that is already protected.
Contact tracing to stop the spread of COVID-19.
So I think it's important for a skeptical left to exist and to not be afraid of being branded as conspiracists to the extent that they do respect science and respect the danger of putting forward disinformation about the pandemic.
COVID-19 narratives.
The exit polls show that the vote count in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and WBAI in New York may have been flipped electronically.
No, that's totally fake news.
And fake news. Many Americans applauded when Twitter suspended President Donald Trump's Twitter account. But others warn that domestic militarism, high-tech censorship, and surveillance are increasing rapidly. COVID, Race, and Democracy spoke to Black Agenda Report columnist Ajamu Baraka. Neoliberal militarists are comparing the Capitol riot to 9/11 and using it to justify the further militarization of Washington, D.C. and Biden's domestic terrorism bill. At the same time, Biden has appointed infamous militarist Susan Rice to a new position, Director of Domestic Policy. Who do you think will become domestic targets during the Biden-Harris year?
Anybody who's involved in oppositional politics, including those elements that are part of the Black Lives Matter movement, but anyone else who questions U.S. colonial policies, who will advance sharp analysis of the capitalist state, who would question some of the dominant ideals, who would suggest that maybe even the police forces should be withdrawn from certain neighborhoods, who would advocate better relations with U.S. so-called adversaries like the Chinese and the Russians. So it's no telling, because what is going to be seen as acceptable speech and acceptable political practice remains to be seen, because we are entering a new totalitarian era. So I think anybody who is in an opposition to the hegemony of the neoliberal project at some point over the next few years are going to experience the heavy hand of the state. Let me just say this about the state. We've been talking about the censorship coming from these private entities, big tech, Twitter, Facebook, Google, etc., YouTube. We need to make a correction. These entities are, of course, private, but the essence of neoliberalism is the spinning off of elements of the state that are public to private entities. So what we have with these big tech companies is, in fact, the spinning off of the function of speech monitoring and massive surveillance to these private companies. So these companies are, in fact, from my point of view, part of the ideological state apparatus. They are part of the state, just like the private corporate media is part of the state. So we have to expand our understanding of what we refer to as the state.
Yesterday, I signed a petition to Twitter to restore @RealDonaldTrump. The Twitter account of the 45th President of the United States. I didn't share the petition on my social media pages because I didn't want to have to fend off a lot of cancel culture, but I still have enough faith in Pacifica to think I won't get kicked off the air for saying this. What do you think of Twitter's suspension of Trump and 70,000 more accounts that they said were linked to the QAnon conspiracy theory?
I think it's quite troubling, and I understand the disgust, the revulsion people have to Donald Trump. We know who Donald Trump is. He's a sociopath. He's a white supremacist. But Donald Trump is, in fact, America. Donald Trump represents the kind of attitude and the kinds of values that made the U.S. settler state what it is today. So this notion on the part of some liberals that he is some kind of aberration is completely ridiculous. It's, in fact, it's ahistorical. But because of the disgust and because of the very serious legitimation crisis the U.S. is facing and the concern that neoliberal politicians have with the possibility of a return of Donald Trump, they have used the incident on January 6th as their opportunity to not only target Donald Trump as a person, but to target his movement, and I use that in quotations, to undermine a above-ground legal political tendency, a tendency that generated 75 million votes. If they can move against Donald Trump and make a connection between some of his speech and what occurred on January the 6th in order to justify a permanent ban of someone who was the president of the United States with 88 million followers, and then decide arbitrarily that because of the conspiratorial nature of these other accounts, they will be taken down also, and people are cheering because they hate Donald Trump, I think what we're seeing is a monumental mistake being made on the part of liberals who think that this state is their friend and that this state will get rid of Donald Trump, but somehow will be able to maintain a commitment to so-called civil liberties. No, they are conditioning the public to accept the constraints of civil liberties, to have faith in private capitalist entities to determine what is acceptable speech and information that can be disseminated. And they are, in essence, and I believe, setting up the kind of dystopia that we see in science fiction movies, where you have corporate interests that have a complete and total control over every aspect of our lives. And of course, complete and total control over the ideals that are disseminated in those kinds of totalitarian societies. So this is a quite troubling move, and even more troubling by the fact that so many people don't recognize its danger. But it's quite slick. Because like you said, why you don't want to share your petition because people would go crazy if you said in public that you believe that Donald Trump's rights have been violated. So this is a quite dangerous moment because what we see, and in my opinion, is the hegemony of irrationality.
In the 48 hours since Biden became president, Israel bombed Syria, killing a family of four. A U.S. convoy of trucks crossed into Syria to steal oil, yet again. A double suicide bombing in Baghdad killed 32 people. And Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations, published a piece with the headline, quote, "The Myth of a Responsible Withdrawal from Afghanistan," unquote, which said, quote, "The Biden administration should accept that there is no feasible middle way for a responsible withdrawal." Unquote. What do you think is next?
The continuation of policies that have resulted in the U.S. being bogged down in Afghanistan for two decades, policies that will ensure that the wars that the U.S. is involved in will continue, that there will be a continuation of the commitment to U.S. global full spectrum dominance. In other words, war and violence is still at the center of the neoliberal project, and they intend to reintroduce that instrument under the Biden administration. You know, there were reports and leading up to the election that the Democrat Party associated elements were secretly suggesting to the Afghan authorities that they would not have to worry about a peace process being executed once Joe Biden came to power. And they made that argument using some of the same terms and framework that we saw in that article in Foreign Affairs, that the U.S. had a responsibility to remain in Afghanistan. And so they were fully prepared to undermine whatever progress was made toward extracting U.S. forces from that territory. So we're not surprised. We see the kind of elements that Biden has brought into his administration. And these are the elements that were part of the Obama administration. And all of these elements are committed to the U.S. national security strategy, which is committed to attempting to maintain U.S. global hegemony using the instrument that they believe they are dependent on now, which is in fact global violence.
That was Ajamu Baraka, Black Agenda Report columnist and founder of the Black Alliance for Peace. A longer conversation with him on this subject will be published in this week's Black Agenda Report at blackagendareport.com.
Don't say words you're gonna regret.
Max Blumenthal, founder and editor of The Gray Zone, also spoke to COVID Race and Democracy about the merger of high-tech monopolies in the state.
Well, the censorship that we're seeing on social media is heavily influenced by the national security state, which Silicon Valley depends on for contracts. There's no coincidence that Amazon is moving its national headquarters to Northern Virginia, which is the home of Langley, the CIA, the Pentagon, and across the river, the FBI, and down the road in Northern Virginia, there's the NSA. So the national security state and its representatives can go to a Silicon Valley CEO and say, you don't want to do what we want? No contracts for you. And I really wonder why there's so little reporting on how social media companies are so easily manipulated by the national security state and why they form partnerships with organizations like the Atlantic Council, which is NATO's unofficial think tank in Washington, funded by the arms industry, the State Department, the Gulf states, and NATO, as I mentioned, and they play a role in verification for Facebook. So let's say they see someone, quote unquote, echoing the Kremlin's narrative, which could mean that you oppose the dirty war in eastern Ukraine, or you oppose the U.S. dirty war on Syria, you could have the algorithm shifted on you to the point where you're no longer able to pick up likes or followers. I can't say for certain that that's taken place, but we published an article that contained an interview in a private forum with Jamie Fly, who is a neoconservative leader, a leader of the neoconservative movement. This was in 2018. Who's a fellow at the Atlantic Council and who is also connected with another initiative sponsored by the U.S. government to censor social media. And he promised that there would be much more social media censorship coming down the pike. So the point is, these aren't billionaires just deciding to be responsible by banning Trump after a riot that he helped inspire. These are billionaires who are carrying out a very deliberate long-term agenda advanced by the national security state to buttress the center, the corporate wings of the Democratic and Republican Party, and to shave off the left and right. And the right is, of course, experiencing it much more harshly because they're more forceful than what passes for the left in the U.S., as we saw at the Capitol. The right is actually willing to put their principles on the line, and they are horrible principles. They are fascistic ideals, but they're willing to put them on the line. They speak in a much more direct way on social media, and therefore they're being prosecuted and banned. What passes for the left in the U.S.? Well, when George W. Bush stole the 2000 election in broad daylight, were there any protests? Was there anything? I remember going to a protest in Los Angeles, and there were like 100 older hippies there. It was pathetic. So the left will face maybe some kind of marginalization, but to the extent that it remains neutered and ineffective, it won't face the same kind of censorship.
Every breath you take, every move you make, every bond you break, every step you take, I'll be watching you. Every single day, and every word you say, every game you play, every night you stay, I'll be watching you.
I published an article by Jeremy Lofredo and Michelle Greenstein on the role of Bill Gates as oligarch number one in exploiting the pandemic for personal gain, and his own record of doing harm to people in the global south to advance profitable vaccinations and other quick fixes to infectious disease. It's pretty shocking to read, and no one has produced anything to contend with what we put forward. But, you know, as far as what I'd like to do in covering the pandemic, it's important to report on the surveillance mechanisms that are being put into place. There are a lot of people who do receive the World Economic Forum's discussions of the Great Reset in a conspiratorial way, but the World Economic Forum is calling for a Great Reset. It is using the pandemic as a kind of shock doctrine moment. And we, the public, don't have much of a say in this organization and how its agenda is implemented. So it's important to at least look at what they're putting forward as a kind of blueprint or a proposal of a sector of the technocratic elite. And they help produce the crisis that we're currently in. So it should be looked at with enormous scrutiny and not just dismissed. So there's definitely more room to do reporting. And I would say personally, I'm disturbed that Anthony Fauci has been built up as this kind of savior, in the same way that some people have built up AOC or Barack Obama as a savior. It's a really telltale sign of failing liberalism, which has failed to produce material change for its own constituents, that they conceive and conjure up these celebrities and then spend their time sort of defending them or upholding them as good-doing totems against the evil-doing Trump. And Fauci has received so much undue political support and celebrity worship that he's felt comfortable admitting that he lied twice to the American public in order to manipulate them to enact behaviors that he thought were productive during the pandemic. He admitted that he lied about masks and their effectiveness, and he admitted that he lied about the level of herd immunity that the public would need to achieve in order for these kind of lockdown measures to end. And that's really disturbing, but because of the nature of the corporate media and how it's pushing an agenda that really doesn't scrutinize people who have credentials, who are given undue credibility, Fauci has escaped really any criticism except from the right. And that's one of the most dangerous ways the public has reacted to the pandemic in the U.S., at least politically, is that all criticism and skepticism has been ceded to the right, ceded to the kind of QAnon conspiracists, including about Bill Gates. So I think it's important for a skeptical left to exist and to not be afraid of being branded as conspiracists to the extent that they do respect science and respect the danger of putting forward disinformation about the pandemic.
That was Max Blumenthal, founder and editor of The Gray Zone.
I'll be watching you.
This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. At the end of December, Glenn Greenwald spoke to the British YouTube channel Unheard about how big tech is censoring debate about COVID-19.
And I think if you look at the history of censorship, it's very rare that we go from one day of free expression to suddenly some melodramatic event that makes it clear beyond all doubt that there's no longer the ability to speak freely. It happens incrementally, almost imperceptibly by design. The tactic typically is that someone who is particularly hated, who everyone across the ideological spectrum can unify to agree, is just so beyond the pale that we're just going to kind of make an exception because this person is such a toxic influence that they deserve to be excluded from any kind of platform. And you have some of those examples that you can point to when all of the Czech giants got together and decided that Milo Yiannopoulos was that kind of person and just disappeared him from the internet, or did the same thing to Alex Jones, or to more obscure kind of, say, overt neo-Nazis. That's always the kind of strategy that's used, is you find the person that everyone agrees that is detestable and offers nothing positive to the discourse and just cheers because of the emotional reaction to having that person gone. But suddenly the precedent is established that there are now lines that are being drawn by tech companies and, of course, or governments. And very predictably, that line starts to move inward toward the mainstream very slowly, very gradually, and very imperceptibly each day or each week or each month. And suddenly you kind of wake up and you see these rights slipping away, and it's kind of like a tide that keeps coming in. You hope it doesn't come and get to you, and as long as it doesn't, you feel free on the beach, but you see the water inching ever closer.
So one example, which I think is a difficult one, but one that we've been engaging in quite a lot, is responses to the COVID pandemic. We actually had a YouTube video taken down earlier this year by a very harmless, kind of commonly featured on the BBC commentator, who apparently was not sufficiently emphasizing the dangers of the pandemic. And YouTube took it down. We managed to get it reinstated. But that was part of their policy, which was that anything that might appear to deviate from WHO guidance would be taken down. And I now know that Twitter, as of this week, has promised to take down anything that is deemed to be anti-vax. So when the tech platforms are now actually playing kind of arbiters of what health information is right or not, is that a dangerous step for them to be taking?
It's incredibly dangerous. First of all, the obvious question arises, which is what competency do tech giants have to arbitrate debates over science and health policy? I know a lot of people in Silicon Valley. Some of them are very skillful at a very narrow set of human capabilities, like computer code or marketing or envisioning how new websites might function. How in any way does that make them in a position of some sort of philosopher king to be able to sit in judgment as overlords of our discourse and decree not only what is impermissible or permissible, but also what is true and false when it comes to very highly complex questions, such as how to manage a pandemic, or whether vaccines are safe and effective, or whether the balances of a lockdown are justified by their costs. These are incredibly complicated decisions that society ought to be debating. And when you have executives with Facebook or Google or Twitter posturing as competent experts to regulate the discourse, the obvious question is, well, what competence do they have? So then their answer is, well, we're going to farm it out to experts who will tell us what is true and what is false, and we'll just defer to their expertise. So you've seen, for example, throughout the course of the pandemic, as you alluded to in your question, YouTube and Twitter and Facebook essentially banning any kind of thought or opinion that deviates from the World Health Organization on the grounds that that's the gold standard for how to understand science. Well, if you look at the history of the pandemic and the role that, the WHO has played in it, they've issued all kinds of statements that we now, by consensus, believe were totally false. Back in February and March, not only were they telling everyone that masks were unnecessary, they were telling everybody that masks were counterproductive. And you can go through the list. I mean, they were in early on questioning whether human-to-human transmission was even possible, whether the virus was really dangerous. So what that's the nature of human fallibility, is that what looks like a proven orthodoxy one month becomes a gross error the next. And that's exactly why these things have to be debated rather than suppressed.
So does that mean you would be against anything being taken off on kind of public health grounds? I mean, if someone goes out there, you know, campaigning against taking a vaccine because they say that it's filled with microchips and it's going to be linked to Bill Gates, or, you know, that something that, you know, most people would deem to be obviously not true, you still think it should be out there and allowed, and you just rely on people's common sense to decide whether they agree with it or not?
Well, you rely on people's common sense, but also the ability of institutions of authority to rebuild trust. You know, the way that, and maybe this is the fact that I'm American, and the American tradition regarding free speech does tend to be a bit more absolutist than even in Western Europe and in other places throughout the democratic world. But we, as a country, have never allowed the government, for example, to intervene in our public debates and our public discourse and render off limits certain opinions because they're designed to spread disinformation. That's something that we've decided is best left to the citizenry to resolve. And of course, I mean, you can concoct examples like the one that you created, where someone might say, well, what's the benefit of allowing something obviously false to be disseminated? And the answer is, well, there may not be a benefit to allowing it to be disseminated, but the risks or the dangers of allowing or empowering institutions to suppress it are worse than the dangers of allowing it to be disseminated. And I think that's the answer. So, you know, one of the problems I think that we have with regard to these questions about disinformation is that we used to have institutions of authority in the media, in academia, in health policy, that gained the trust of the population. So if somebody popped up and started spouting conspiracy theories, you had trusted media outlets or scholars or, you know, health organizations to say, no, that's actually untrue. The science proves otherwise. And all but a small handful of people trusted those pronouncements. That credibility has been eroded. And I think one of the things that we need to do, rather than now starting to use brute force to say we're just not going to allow people to express things that these institutions declare to be false, is question why it is that we've lost trust as a profession of journalism, or why experts have lost trust. I think there's a lot of reasons that lie within the behavior of those elites, and that to me seems like a much better solution.
We just heard Glenn Greenwald, thanks to the British YouTube channel Unheard. And now we'll hear from our secret news reporter, George Carlin.
And the announcer whispering, saying, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the secret news. And the news ticker gets louder and he goes, shh, and the ticker lowers. Here's the secret news. All people are afraid. No one knows what they're doing. Everything is getting worse. Some people deserve to die. Your money is worthless. No one is properly dressed. At least one of your children will disappoint you. The system is rigged. Your house will never be completely clean. All teachers are incompetent. There are people who really dislike you. Nothing is as good as it seems. Things don't last. No one is paying attention. The country is dying. God doesn't care. Shh.
During the 2017 Holberg debate titled, quote, Propaganda, Facts, and Fake News, Julian Assange argued that the news has always been fake.
I think the media is, in general terms, one of the most destructive forces that has ever existed. It has led to nearly every war that we've had, certainly the wars by democracies, all the big wars that that you can name, at least in the post-World War II period, and to a degree, even in World War II, were built up. Their populations were mobilized on the back of lies, from the Gulf of Tonkin incident to the Iraq War, to the Gulf War. So the average death count per journalist, I did a calculation for US journalists recently, is something like 130 kills per journalist as a result of them not treating their function seriously, which is to provide, well, their supposed or claimed societal function seriously, which is to provide the truth, and instead spreading propaganda and lies of the major power establishments in the countries that they're in. So I want to, first of all, ground this debate about fake news with the reality that the news has always been fake. It has always been something that has been used to manipulate human populations en masse into absolutely disastrous outcomes in order for proprietors of news organizations to, yes, make profits by peddling salacious stories, but much more significantly, to keep their integration with existing establishments in those countries and at a social level for each journalist and editor to ingratiate themselves socially with the very establishments they are meant to be policing. The renewed talk about fake news, well, it's been taken up by Donald Trump in his critiques of CNN, for example. Okay, now, is it true that those responses by Donald Trump are motivated by a president in power trying to distract from critique of the press? Absolutely. Of course, that's the motivation. But is he nonetheless, in general terms, correct? Yes, in general terms, he is correct. CNN, I don't mean to pick on it unnecessarily. It's certainly not the only one. All the big establishment media in the United States, Fox News, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, are filled every day with very serious and misleading fake news. Why is the term being popularized other than politicians and other people who are criticized in the media using it to rebuff that criticism, whether that criticism is true or, as it very often is, false? Well, the US election, principally last year, saw an outbreak of uncontrolled popularism. Now, that popularism was harnessed by what is it, effectively neo-fascistic cultural sentiments. That's true. It was harnessed in various ways by those groups. But nonetheless, it is a democratic outburst that occurred principally because of the increased ease with which human beings can share information with each other, social media, small publishers, etc. And that, of course, has led to cultural change, not simply because of underpinning reasons, which many people on the left talk about, such as the decline in US real wages from 1978, or by the concerns that people on the right talk about, for example, increased immigration, but rather because the establishment press is integrated with the existing order of things and has been used to create that order and to maintain it. Now, whether you see a decrease in the existing order as a positive or a negative depends on where you think that is going and whether you stand to lose or gain in the process of that change. Let's do a little thought experiment. Do we accept that the press has a serious influence on society and the ideas that are passed around? We all know that the press has been used to mobilize nations for illegal wars, for example. In democracy, especially, the press is one of the principal controlling functions of the existing establishment, the existing order of things. So when that control structure can be worked around, social media, new publishers starting up with very little capital because of the internet. Is that going to change the existing order of things? Obviously, if your claim was that the press is intimately part of the existing order of things, and there's a new press which is not part of the existing order of things, then obviously the order, the cultural order, and to some degree clearly the relative balance of who has power and who does not is going to change. So this has terribly frightened existing establishments, and those existing establishments, of course, integrated with the establishment press by definition. So why we see such talk in the establishment press about the fear of fake news is not simply because it's another thing to be salacious about. Change in the informational control system, of which the existing establishment press was a major component, leads to a decrease in power of the existing establishment and a decrease in power of the existing establishment press. So all those little publishers, social media, etc., are both in some sense direct rivals for establishment press power. So the existing establishments, including of course the press, which is integrated with them, see this uncontrolled phenomenon as a direct threat to their power and also to the existing order, which creates fear in themselves and also directly for the press itself. So the press talks about it a lot and tries to push forwards for there to be greater controls in the spreading of information. And this has then led to a very serious situation, extremely serious situation, where pressure has been applied to Facebook, Google, these giant new digital superstates, these giant intermediaries, to regain control of the informational flow system of the West, broadly speaking.
That was Julian Assange speaking at the 2017 Holberg debate in Oslo. Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Contact tracing to stop the spread of COVID-19 has stirred fears that it will lead to privacy violations. I asked Bay Area privacy activist and Media Alliance Executive Director Tracy Rosenberg to explain contact tracing and concerns about it.
Contact tracing is the process of creating a map of a person's movements and associations in order to identify the possible spread of an infectious disease. Before the age of digital technology, it was an onerous process of sort of paper surveys and giant piles of filled out forms, which, while they contained very personal information, had some practical limitations in terms of how far the information could spread. In the age of digital technology, the ability to retain and repurpose and search large chains of data is greater than it has ever been before.
What dangers does it pose?
Well, there are quite a few. One is sort of what we call emergency protocols. A large tracing program set up under emergency or panicked conditions can lead to incomplete frameworks and poorly trained personnel, including some with relatively little or no familiarity with health data protection. When data protection, storage, and access protocols are poorly planned, then you get potentially leaks, hacks, unauthorized access, and those kinds of problems.
Can you describe what a well-planned data protection plan would be? Who would have access to what and who not? And how would we know that the FBI, CIA, NSA hadn't gotten into it?
Yeah, it's not an easy or simple question, but generally data protection requires a couple of things, including retention limits. In other words, only keeping things for as long as you actually need them for something and not for longer. Disaggregating bulk data from personally identifying information as soon as possible. Clear demarcations for access by job title, who can get into the data and who can't. Several layers of anti-hacking security protections, clear consent procedures, training. Those are some of the things that go into a proper data security plan. An emergency like a pandemic is always the enemy of planned data protections, but there have been some efforts. For example, California privacy groups tried to pass protective legislation in 2020 for contact tracing. The bills were AB 1782 and AB 660. And some of the things that they would have done is they would have had procedures for providing and revoking consent, required at least some level of encryption for stored data, required public reports and metrics every 90 days, and prevented law enforcement agencies from participating in or having access to contact tracing data. That's a fairly broad summary, but it gives you sort of the idea. And sadly, both bills were vetoed by Governor Newsom, who said in his veto message that he didn't want regulations that might slow down contact tracing efforts. It's kind of a habitual trend in American politics that we don't want to talk about privacy during emergencies, which has led to revelations of upsetting practices after the fact. In theory, agencies like the FBI, CIA, NSA should have no access to health data that is already protected under law. But in an emergency with a bunch of entities that are both public and private sort of rushing in to try to help and set up new processes, that's exactly how the guardrails slip and things happen that were not supposed to happen.
Doesn't any privacy protection plan or policy depend on the good faith of those expected to implement and or follow it? This is true with any policy, but the use of big data seems particularly difficult to detect.
Good faith only goes so far. I mean, firstly, it probably is not a good idea to depend on the intentions of government agencies as a whole, which are filled with a large variety of people. I believe most public health officials are conscientious, but can't say anything concrete about 100% of the people involved in anything. And the nature of a pandemic is to draw in other agencies and entities with relatively little experience or possibly no experience with handling large amounts of health data and what we call personally identifying information, or PII. In general, my approach to privacy regulation is that enforcement is required. It's not based on good faith. A policy without enforcement protocols and consequences for violations is more like a recommendation.
Singapore has already excluded anyone who refuses to participate in contact tracing from access to public space, and openly stated that they will make data available to police to investigate crimes. That's not surprising because Singapore is one of the most tightly and openly controlled states in the world. But who is pressing for mandatory participation here?
I'm not aware of anyone in the United States in a position of power who has openly pushed for mandatory participation in contact tracing. It is possible that there's someone, but I'm not aware of it. But as I mentioned, there's definitely concern, and I think a real problem, about at least partially coerced participation, with employers pressuring employees or educational bureaucracies pressuring teachers and students, that sort of have people fearing informal retaliation or discrimination if they prefer not to participate. In my view, mandated participation would require extensive safeguards. Laissez-faire shouldn't only operate in one single direction. If the government will not take action to safeguard my personal information, then I have a choice whether to trust them with it or not. So to me, any kind of mandated participation or even pressured participation should come with a guarantee that the government is going to keep my data safe and has a real data protection plan, which they currently don't.
That was Tracy Rosenberg, Bay Area privacy activist and executive director of Media Alliance. And now we'll turn to TwitWit Radio for some fake news, half true, more or less, 100% of the time.
Are we ready?
Present.
Ready.
Let's go.
The Russians are coming.
Oh, do you think so?
That's fake news, dude.
The category is fake news. For 100 points, give a half-true answer to this question. What's the difference between fake news and real news?
The what?
Could you repeat the question, please?
What is the difference between fake news and real news?
Real news is less fake.
Wrong.
Fake news is more real.
Wronger.
Fake news is half true and real news is the opposite.
We have a tie. Nobody wins.
Yeah! Again. Me too.
What's happening?
Wow, really? I didn't win.
This is TwitWit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time. This is round two. For 200 points, give a misleading answer to this question. Is fake news free speech?
Free what?
The Supreme Court ruled on it.
Fact check.
The Supreme Court ruled in Fox versus Whistleblower, news programs are under no obligation to report the truth.
We are talking about fake news with top experts in the field.
Fake news reporter on line three.
Go ahead.
This is Sylvia Pozzoli reporting from the grassroots radio conference on the third ring of Saturn.
Where are you?
The mood in Moscow this evening is apprehensive. Inside the Kremlin, President Putin spent the day deleting 75 Thunderbolts cast in Detroit, Michigan. This is Sylvia Pozzoli reporting from Comet Pizza in Red Square. President Putin and Ivanka Trump are approaching the podium.
Мы что, разве не знаем, что официальные органы Соединенных Штатов за всеми подглядывают и всех подслушивают? Значит, хорошо, всем известно, давно уже это не секрет никакой.
Эдвард Сноуден и Джулиан Ассанж are in bed with John Podesta and Bernie Sanders, who is not a double agent intelligence asset. Never trust anyone.
Признание полное. Причем следят не только за своими потенциальными противниками.
Sylvia, can President Putin take questions?
До свидания.
Did Russia hack the local station board elections at Pacifica Radio?
The Soviet Union and the United States were not really enemies. The Cold War was a hoax. It was like suddenly the veil was lifted.
Oh, put the veil down. I don't believe it. The Cold War was fake news.
I already knew that.
There's no such thing as truth.
Does anyone else know about this?
Everybody knows about it except the little people.
Is the new Cold War fake news?
Everybody finds out about it sometime.
Does Rachel Maddow know?
Everything about her is fake.
But I'm in love with Rachel Maddow.
Wake up and smell the caca, phony.
What else is fake news?
The Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor.
Really? Oh, my God.
There is no God, and she does not care about you.
I have long suspected that. What else?
Fidel Castro was a lifelong military intelligence asset.
And if the Cold War didn't exist, it would have been necessary to create it.
Or to recreate it.
Authorities in both countries are eager to negotiate new fake news standards. This is Brian Williams reporting from Moscow.
Brian Williams, the fake newsman?
I never trusted him.
He's an admitted corporate news hack.
A professional liar.
I think Brian Williams is hot. He has great production values.
Maybe you don't feel strong enough to smash the state, but maybe you can dent the state. 1,000 dents equals 1 smash. Come on, everyone, dent the state!
Fake news needs a makeover.
Oh, makeover to what? Uh-huh.
Better fake news.
This is Sylvia Pozzoli reporting from Moscow. Edward Snowden is in bed with First Lady Ludmilla Putin.
Fake, but entertaining.
There are going to be changes. Sylvia Pozzoli will be the new show host of this program.
This is Sylvia Pozzoli reporting for Pacifica Radio from Moscow. The exit polls show that the vote count in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and WBAI in New York may have been flipped electronically.
No, that's totally fake news.
Fake news is protected free speech, dude.
I'm Berkeley Kidd. This is Twit Wit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Thanks to Twit Wit Radio for that cutting-edge fake news and fake news analysis. Now, there is one voice that we ran out of time to include today, but he'll be on next week in the second installment of our series on COVID in prisons.
All power to the people.
All power to the people!
Peace and blessings, sisters and brothers. My name is Malik Washington, and I'm the new editor of the San Francisco Bayview National Black Newspaper.
His name is Malik Washington, and he became a journalist while imprisoned in Texas. Now he's moved to San Francisco to become the new editor of the San Francisco Bayview National Black Newspaper. The Bayview has a website, sfbayview.com, but it also prints a real newspaper once a month and mails bundles of it to prisons all over the U.S. The paper is a lifeline to prisoners, and it publishes prison voices. Malik Washington is on parole, living in a geogroup reentry facility, which has had an outbreak of COVID-19. But he has not been granted early release, even though he has a job, a home to go to, and a weekly guest spot on KPFA's Flashpoints Radio.
What this fight is about is what the Bureau of Prisons has tried to cover up. This is really retaliation against journalists for attempting to exercise their First Amendment rights. And it's not just Malik's cell phone that has been taken away. He actually has a gag order on him right now.
For more on Malik, see the Bayview website, sfbayview.com, and tune in next week to hear him on COVID, race, and democracy. That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Van Garrison. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Seltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.